and mining, but that was about it. The ball guests might look as though they were paying attention to their food, or to the music, or to one of her many artistic displays, but all such distractions were merely blinds that hid the true object of the guests' attention, the governor herself. Ashel knew that all eyes were on her, judging her, trying to determine what direction her administration might take. The sensation of being a stranger in her own home wasn't new to her. The ballroom was packed with members of the Grevenet and their families, as well as various adepts, luminaries, and other citizens wealthy or influential enough to merit an invitation. Coronations and state funerals were sombre affairs, laden with gravitas and ceremony. But the devotional banquet, following the installation of a new Lord Governor, was a true celebration, and for many, a once-in-a-lifetime event. The crowd was arrayed in their finest, with most nobles dressed in garments that cost more than any of their servants would make in their entire careers. Fine silks, neotex collars, and Trophidian feathers were on display, along with materials more exotic yet, all crafted by the most elite tailors and haberdashers on the planet. If the reception was to be her introduction to the nobles of Shokan, her chance to make an opening statement, she had decided early it would be a declaration of conservative plenty. The Colonnadium Mechanate, the enclosed columned hall that surrounded the Dehava ballroom, had been refitted with the finest art pieces the Matkissons owned. Paintings, weavings, furnishings and sculptures from the breadth of the planet, many older than the noble houses represented in attendance, were on display for all to admire. Her chefs had not created any new or bizarre dishes, had imported nothing from off-world, and had designed no titanic displays of culinary theatre. Instead, the food she had served showcased the entire palette of Shokan cuisine, from hearty Kostoki steak to salted Pelusidian fish pastries. Two separate instrumental ensembles staged at opposite ends of the ballroom alternated music in a variety of styles popular throughout Shokani history. Despite being surrounded by those anxious to get her measure, she drew some small comfort having Henrik by her side. He was a supportive presence, distant for 20 years he might have been, but he was nonetheless a family member she had known from childhood, who shared her blood and at least the core of her values. At the same time, his presence had a transient quality that added to his safety. He wasn't going to be staying for more than a few days, so he had no worth to any long-term plans of potential rivals. It was a strange combination that ultimately made him more comforting and trustworthy than anyone else around her. "I got most of it," she said, watching the Magos amble away. "He asked us to divert fishing in the northern ice bays while his teams conduct a mineral survey. At least the priesthood of Mars is direct in their approach. This will probably be the only time Magos Crowfield sees me all year unless I summon him, which the governor generally only does if there's an emergency. So logic dictates he make any request he has now. To tell the truth, I prefer the directness." The supplicant was already approaching them. Ashiel sat apart from the dancers and diners, upon a raised dais of ebulite marble, the stone's natural luminescence dulled to a faint yellow glow by the centuries that had passed since its mining. Those who wished to speak with her had to ascend the wide, shallow steps and ascend to her level, to address her as she sat in the great padded seat which had served as her throne. Blood-red velvet atop ferron wood dredged from the Trenkovi bogs. Age had darkened the wood to a glossy black. The tree that had provided the wood had been extinct before humans had set foot on the planet, preserved and petrified in the moss-choked mud for thousands of years. The specific trunk that would one day become the throne of Shokan would have sprouted, grown and died when the skies and oceans of holy terror still ran blue. Margrave Lagaret Gavosny was a woman Ashiel had never personally met, but had heard much about. Paula and Ashiel had, during many long conversations at university, confided their personal opinions of their own family members to one another. Paula's father had been, like Ashiel, the second child of the ruling member of his house. Unlike Ashiel, his elder sister had survived and had become Margrave shortly after Henrik's birth. The Govoznys had made their fortune in chemical processing, most specifically dye works, although they had expanded as the years had rolled on. From what Paolo had told her, her aunt Lagarette was a single-minded woman who had never let loyalty, mercy, or empathy get in the way of lining her family's coffers.
"Lord Governor Matkison," said Lagarette as she reached the last stair, "we thank you for your generous hospitality. May I present my own daughter, Quelevia Gavosny?"
The Margrave Gavosny was a stout woman, short and thickly muscled. She did no manual labour that Ashiel was aware of, and instead had perfected her strong physique only for herself. From what Paolo had told her, the Margrave had been a successful bare-knuckle brawler in her youth, and was not above using her physicality to intimidate some of the idle, perfumed nobles with whom she had business dealings. In many ways, Quelevia was the opposite of her mother. Her hands were folded in front of her, her gaze lowered timidly. She was small and withdrawn, and when she mumbled an echo of her mother's thanks, her voice shook with fear.
"So lovely to have you both," said Ashiel. "May I offer you a sweet?"
She gestured to the servitor standing next to her, holding a tray of ice-cold cubes of shivering Macarellian gelatin. The servitor, like all the other navigating the crowd with trays of food and drink, was a pinnacle of cybernetic craft. The flesh was clean and dressed in Matkison's servant's livery, the artificial components oiled, maintained, and silent. The slack faces had been covered by porcelain masks made to honour the faces of long-serving former employees of the palace. They were particular points of interest for the guests. The works aboard the Calistonian Haven absorbed most of the servitors produced on Shokan, and the agri-works took the majority that remained. Most noble houses could only afford a single servitor, and many had none at all.
"You are most gracious, my lord, but no."
Margrave Gavosny had a grim half-smile. Ashiel wondered what manner of game the woman was playing.
"It is my daughter who has a request of you."
She turned to Quelevia.
"Don't you stand there, child. The Lord Governor has a busy evening."
"So sorry, Your Excellency."
Quelevia seemed unsure what to do with herself and made do with a curtsy.
"However, I'm old enough now to enter into holdings of my own."
"I see," said Ashiel. She smiled and leaned forward, trying to relax her posture to be as unintimidating as possible.
"There is some significant demand for our family's goods," the young woman said, eyeing her mother uncomfortably. "However, my elder family members have the demands sufficiently covered."
Ashiel understood the girl's plight. She didn't want to earn her mother's disapproval by spelling out the naked truth. Fortunately, she was up to date on the economics of Shokan, and she already knew that the Govosny's fortunes were stable, but had no room for expansion at the moment. The expanding population required housing, not fabric dyes. "Did you have something in mind?" Ashiel asked. The traditional holdings of a noble family were the most common occupation for its members, but by no means the only one available to them. Quelevia nodded.
"Yes, Excellency. I have a partner, my betrothed, Theola Clavin, who is a vintner by trade."
The name wasn't familiar to Ashiel, which meant the partner wasn't a member of any ruling families. Quelevia was a third child, however, which meant her family would have no concerns allowing her to marry outside her class. Ashiel saw the trouble, however, and the trap Margrave Gavosny believed she was laying for Ashiel. The family trades associated with each noble house might not be a requirement for them, but they were protected industries by law. Food production was the undisputed territory of the Matkisons. Vineyards occupied a legal grey area. Some court rulings had found them to be classified as food or beverage enterprises, and thus the province of the Matkisons. Others, particularly the smallest and most elite, had been ruled as artistic endeavours and thus belonging to no house as a default matter of law. To make matters even more tricky, all the best land for the growing vitiberries were prime arable land and thus owned by the Matkisons unless otherwise granted. If Ashiel wanted to help Quelevia Gavosny,
she would need to give away a portion of her own land and cede a business enterprise that could arguably be considered hers to a noble house that did not operate in her favour. If she refused, she could be seen as petty, holding on to a small scrap of land she wasn't using, and undermining the empathetic and reasonable image she had cultivated for herself. "What a lovely idea," Ashiel said. She looked at Margrave Gavosny in the eye. "I believe I could, conditionally, spare a few square miles outside of Trenkovi Bay, say 15? The eyes of the Gavosny women widened in shock. No vineyard of that size had ever been classified as an artistic endeavour before.
"What conditions?"
Lagarette asked, her eyes narrowing in suspicion. Ashiel smiled. "Taxes paid at trade rate, until such time as the value of the property has been repaid. In addition to standard tithes and taxes, 1% of your daughter's production by vintage to be diverted to the palace." She nodded at Quilivia. "We must keep our own stocks plentiful after all." Turning back to Lagarette, she added another clause, as if as an afterthought. "And the labourers, both seasonal and permanent, to be recruited from a city of the governor's choosing in perpetuity. You can begin with, we'll say, 300 workers from Selpagam." Margrave Lagarette nearly laughed out loud. The terms were quite generous, but more to the point, they did nothing to harm the fortunes of the Gavosny family. They would, however, bode poorly for the Venaissans, who had already accepted contracts to build additional housing in Selpagam, some of which would sit vacant now that a few hundred workers would be moved to another continent.
"Thank you, Your Excellency,"
Quilivia gushed. Ashiel gave her a gracious smile and a wave as the young woman's mother guided her down the dais and away into the crowd. Another petty trap of her enemies averted. At least that one had been relatively easy. Henrik grimaced as they watched the crowd, waiting for the next guest to approach. "They all want something. It's all so avaricious. I thought the evening was supposed to be a show of loyalty to you." She smiled again, this time openly and genuinely. The parade of supplicants had begun the moment she walked into the ballroom, and would likely continue through the night. "And most of them demonstrate that loyalty with pretty words and trivial gifts," she said. "Then, of course, they reason that they should immediately capitalise on that loyalty before I have the opportunity to divine whether or not they've truly earned it." The gifts meant little to her, save for those rare few that were personal and meaningful, like the embossed book of neo-legalist poetry that Paolo had delivered earlier. That was the image she had attempted to convey. From the food to the music to the artwork to the grand architecture of Darkadon that she had laid open to the Grevenet, it all spoke to the same message. The massive arched ribs of the ballroom, the ancient throne, the goods both fine and mundane from every reach of her planet, told everyone present that nothing was beyond her grasp. It was no accident that she had chosen the Dahava ballroom for her devotional banquet. As the highest point of the palace's northern side, the glass windows of the Colonnadium Mechanate offered a stunning vista of the palace to the south and east, and the rolling countryside to the north. To the west, the entire city of Costovium lay before the viewers, the lights stretching to the horizon to blend nearly seamlessly with the stars of the night sky. The message, she hoped, was clear. This was a person who has everything. Not through ostentation, but through completeness, venerability, and reliability. She showed that her means were as close to infinite as mattered on Shokan. Her wealth was so vast as to make her unbribable. If she had to make a single statement to begin her reign, she would make it a declaration that she could not be bought, for there was nothing she did not have, and little she could not afford to give in service to her world. "That's appalling," said Henrik, drawing her thoughts back to the conversation at hand.
"Does it really work differently on Sorinu?"
asked Ashiel. "Sorinu is a shrine world," he said. "So the influential elite tend to be members of the Ecclesiarchy,
and a little more focused on maintaining an appearance of pious loyalty. She might have hoped to continue the conversation for a while longer, as much to postpone the inevitable torrent of personal requests as to hear more about her brother's new home. But Baron's arrival ended that. The group captain's stern expression told her it was not mere social formality that brought him out. "Mom," he said.
"What is it?"
"One of the visitors was observed discreetly sneaking into the servants' corridors off the main room," he whispered. Aware of how many eyes were upon her, Ashiel smiled as though he had told her something charming and innocuous.
"Whom?"
she asked.
"Tanzeg Van Aysen and his guest."
The thought of Tanzeg Van Aysen sneaking through the halls of her palace was disturbing enough, but the notion that he might have a greater agenda concerned her even more.
"Where was he spotted, Fidel?"
She smiled and leaned in as if laughing at a private joke.
"By the Draper's Hall, Mom."
Inside, she fumed. Tanzeg creeping off into the shadows for a covert liaison with whatever woman he'd bribed into accompanying him, she could see as being mere coincidence. But the same footman's hall she'd nearly been cornered in. Her father had had a saying, "When conspiracy goes abroad, coincidence is the mask it wears." And she was beginning to see the wisdom in it.
"Then we should go and see if there's anything he needs," she said as she stood.
Hanrik stood as well, confused.
"A runaway guest? Does that warrant your personal intervention?" he asked.
How much she could reveal to Hanrik still weighed upon her. To tell him everything, Jezubiel and all, might be more than he could handle. He was an arbitrator after all, and she couldn't trust the bonds of blood to take precedence over the oaths he had taken. Still, she might need his assistance if things were to go too far awry.
"The Draper's Hall is the closest point to the corridor where I was attacked," she said. "If my assassin, or those who hired him, were to return to the scene of their attack to destroy evidence, or to ensure none remained, that's the route they would take."
Hanrik nodded, and she was grateful that his assistance required no more explanation than that. Her brother gestured for Fidel to lead, and the three of them made their way through the crowd, Ashiel responding to all inquiries about her departure with a smile and an offhand comment about a minor domestic issue that required her attention. She thought about summoning her guards, but she couldn't simply have Tanzeg arrested. Not without cause, at any rate. And slipping away from a ball to stink up a side hallway was hardly grounds for a charge of high treason. Arresting Tanzeg, or even his whole family, wouldn't give rise to much ire in the general population. But the Grevenate members who owed loyalty, coerced or otherwise, to the coadjutor family could cause her no end of grief. To her dismay, they didn't catch Tanzeg doing anything untoward at all. She half expected to find him attempting to force his way through the cellar door when they arrived, but to her displeasure, he was coming her way, with a woman by his side whom Ashiel didn't recognise.
"Oh, Excellency," he said, his voice slightly slurred. "What a pleasant surprise."
The hallway, already uncomfortably narrow, felt crowded with the sudden tension that filled the air. Tanzeg's guests stiffened, her gaze shifting from the arbitrator, the group captain, and the governor. Ashiel felt a twinge of empathy towards the poor woman. It was clear she wasn't one of the aristocracy, despite her gestures to the contrary. Whatever Tanzeg needed her for, Ashiel doubted the woman had expected to become trapped between the Lord Governor, a member of the Adeptus Arbites, and one of the planet's most powerful crime lords. She admired the woman's composure. She had seen people crumble under much less pressure.
"My evening's been full of surprises," Ashiel said.
"Mine as well," Tanzeg replied. "These old buildings are just full of them."
"Not usually, one would imagine, in the wine cellar," said Hanrik.
"I wouldn't know," said Tanzeg, "as Her Excellency has the wine cellar locked behind a rather impressive anchor chain. I suppose such precautions are required when one's own servants can't be trusted."
"Yes, unfortunately, Darkadon seems to play host to a significant number of treacherous types these days,"
she said. Quite. Hanrik's voice had taken on a tone that Ashiel had never heard before, yet seemed somehow familiar. Where were you headed in such a hurry, Mr. Van Aysen? The voice was cold and immutable. If Ceramite spoke, it would sound like that. Tanzeg held up his hands. Ashiel wondered how many times that boyish grin and innocent demeanour had got the Van Aysen out of trouble. If he was angry at having his title dropped, he didn't let it show.
My apologies, Lord Matkeson, he said. Finding a hidden room locked in such a fashion is something I've learned to treat with alarm. Having grown up on Sorinu, you might be unaware, but it's not uncommon for ruling houses on Shokan to have secret rooms with all manner of decadent perversions hidden away from prying eyes. He winked at Ashiel. Not that I imagine Her Excellency is involved in any such wickedness, of course. But such heavy defences on such an innocuous area understandably set off alarm bells for me, you understand. I thought it might be better to withdraw with all haste.
Ashiel narrowed her eyes. His attempts to throw suspicion on her were ludicrous. He suspected his man Lestrovsky had been lost somewhere in this area. But if he hadn't gotten through the door, then there was no way he'd ever be able to prove it.
Withdrawal seems the best course of action, said Hanrik. If you and the young lady have business pressing enough that you need to leave, I'd hate to keep you here.
Ashiel struggled to keep her face grim while the smile faded from Tanzig's face, as the older noble tried to work out if he had been politely dismissed or subtly threatened. The woman beside him seemed relieved to have an out. Tanzeg's mask finally reasserted itself.
Of course, he said. You know how it is when a relationship is exciting and new.
He paused.
Or I'm sure you will.
Hanrik stepped aside, inclining his head towards the way back. Tanzeg flourished his arm elaborately for his companion and swept past them. As he brushed past her in the narrow hall, Tanzeg locked his eyes with Ashiel and grinned. It wasn't a smile of a knavish troublemaker weaseling his way out of a punishment. It was a look of a man genuinely trying to be charming. Ashiel was revolted. At the top of the stairs, once they'd left the servants' corridors, Tanzeg's escort seemed to overcome her timidity.
Oh, Your Excellency, she gushed,
gesturing to one of the tapestries hanging on a nearby wall.
I've never seen such a magnificent piece. Could I trouble you for an explanation of its origin? I confess that my knowledge has failed me on this example, and I'm told you're quite the authority on post-resurgence artefacts.
Ashiel favoured the woman with a gracious smile. Of course, she said. This piece depicts the triumph over Warlord Nagash at the Beth-Terian Divide. It's one of the few physical portrayals of an Inquisitor not sanctioned by the Inquisition. Of course, Inquisitor Heshvara is deliberately shown with an appearance wildly different than his true image. She continued to draw on, the young woman nodding and interjecting questions in a perfect display of feigned fascination. She had to commend the woman's skill. Ashiel hadn't even seen the signal that must have come from Tanzeg to command her to create a distraction. As a con artist, her talents were impeccable. The specific information she was able to cite, gleaned from Ashiel's own contributions to the conversation, made her seem like an avid art history enthusiast. If the woman hadn't mistaken a pre-Solarian piece for post-resurgence at the top of the discussion, Ashiel might not have had any reason to doubt her counterfeit knowledge.
If I can beg your forgiveness, Your Excellency, I was hoping to show my companion the lovely western view,
Tanzeg interjected, politely taking the woman's arm, the picture of courtly decorum. She nodded and thanked Ashiel as she was led away. Ashiel sincerely hoped Tanzeg wasn't placing the woman in danger. She knew Jezubiel wasn't the only monster she'd allowed to walk into the halls of Darkadon. Chapter 8. Jezubiel drifted from shadow to shadow. Perched atop a bronze image of a weeping saint, it stared down into the crowd of humans in the Colonnadium Mechanate.
A few swayed unartfully to the pain-stringed music. To the human senses it was no doubt sublime, but compositions of harmony and rhythm were an anathema to creatures like it. A blink, a heartbeat, and it was behind a corpulent man draped in pale furs. From his proximity to others, Jezubiel guessed the other humans smelled nothing but the stocky man's mild perfume. Crouched in the shadow, Jezubiel could drink in more, much more. Beneath the rancid floral perfume, it could smell the musty shroud of ages, the reminder that this fur cloak had lain unused for many years. Beneath that, however, Jezubiel could smell blood. It could taste the fat from the ursine creature's blubber. It could smell the oily tang of the skinning knife that had harvested the pelt. More importantly, it could feel the creature's shock and pain as the spear had been plunged into its body. The prideful outrage that any puny prey animal had dared to sharpen a stick and come after him. Jezubiel felt a shiver run down its spine as it felt the vengeful fury that had possessed the beast in the moment of its death. And there, just there, at the very edge of its senses, it could detect the tiniest hint of the hunter's own heart, cold and prideful with the knowledge of what it had done. Jezubiel came back to its senses, crouching in the shadow of a credenza, and seethed to itself. The perfumed flesh offered no great arousal. The fur cloak smelled of great pain and pride, but the wearer was soft and simpering. In the space of a glance, it was gone, skulking behind a tapestry, creeping beneath a table, perched atop a ceiling support. On the field of battle it would stick to the deepest shadows, creeping slowly with its brethren. But here, far from the bright-eyed gaze of the terrified or the dull, alert stare of the jaded veteran, it could move with impunity. It might as well have been moving openly among them, as free as it was. It didn't have the psychic puissance of its more refined cousins, but the shadows revealed to Jezubiel what its mind itself could not take. It could smell their fears, could feel their little discomforts, and could taste their unspoken, malevolent urges. It paused behind the old woman in silver. Here was a familiar scent. The night fiend leaned in close, savouring the odour of hate, and shivered as the old woman stiffened. Not quite astute enough to sense its presence, but almost. This was the smell from the ancient manor, the one with the decaying wards. Her children and lesser relations bore the ripe scent of blood and bruise. They were hands that were no strangers to blade and bludgeon. The matriarch was something altogether different. In her it sensed a mind full of barbed points and venomous edges. A wicked mind. It could always reveal himself to her. There was nothing stopping it from showing itself to anyone it chose, from saying what it liked. It might not be able to effect its will on the cattle of this world with claw, blade, or flame, but it could wield a canny word better than anyone else. If it wished, it could betray the young signet bearer who had freed it to this wizened doer of evil. Its brethren would regard it a fool for not doing so. Although it was a master of arts, profound and profane, and witness to secrets so perverse that humans had no vocabulary to describe them, its long incarceration had shown it that there were still skills it had left to learn. In particular, the eternity of insensate imprisonment had taught it patience and foresight. The cruel and vicious little family of murderers in the lesser position would be more satisfying in the short term, certainly. They would shed enough blood that it and its kind could indulge in a feast of agony. A little patience, a little planning, however, offered a far greater reward. With a gentle touch and the right enticement, this world could offer a bounty of torment that would replenish itself for eons. Jezubiel stared at the cold, cruel face of the old woman. It might be satisfying to see her work, but it would be vastly more rewarding to work its arts upon her. As jaded as she was, she too had much still to learn about the infliction of pain.
"I'll have someone sweep for listening devices or infiltration tools, Mom."
Group Captain Baron looked at Hanrik, who concurred with a nod. "No,"
Ashiel said, patting Baron's arm absently. I don't think that will be necessary, she forced a laugh. If we launch an investigation every time a Venaysan slinks away from their responsibilities for some tawdry dalliance, we'll never get any work done. Group Captain Baron laughed along with her, although she noticed Hanrik's stern visage, which gave her pause. She had never before seen him operating as he would in a professional capacity, and the experience had been chilling. Her brother was naturally taciturn and composed, but the Hanrik who had questioned Tanzeg Venaysan with the voice of Ceramite was like a different person. His gaze, his voice, his posture. She realised she had been seeing Hanrik as her little brother and had not adequately understood the man he had become. She had a better perspective now and knew that allaying Hanrik's suspicions needed to remain a priority. If he were to turn the full power of his training and intensity to questioning her, it could be calamitous.
I appreciate Your Excellency's position, Baron said. I would be remiss in my duties, however, if I did not at least attempt to investigate what Lord Tanzeg was doing down here.
Ashiel bit back a sharp response. Baron was proving to be an effective choice as Zalukan's replacement, but his professionalism was currently an impediment. Your diligence in this regard is noted, Group Captain, but I think it is unwarranted. The cyberhounds would have detected if anyone had brought explosives inside, so we know he did not leave a bomb. If Tanzeg were foolish enough to have planted a listening device, then he did so in the most inept place possible, for there are no conversations of importance taking place in the Draper's Hall. She paused as if considering the evidence. If his behaviour is indeed suspicious, I would think it more likely to be a distraction than anything else. If you want to go and make sure he gets back without incident, I'll let my brother escort me back to the ball. If you believe his conduct is worthy of further action, then let us check in with the High Service on patrol, and perhaps call in those who are currently off duty. Properly mollified, Baron nodded and faded into the crowd to execute her commands. Ashiel looped her arm through Hanrik's to guide him back to the ballroom. She didn't have the years of experience with Hanrik that she'd had with Ruprecht or Jordan, but she didn't need a close relationship to read his mistrust. Her mind was racing. She needed to allay his suspicions as quickly as possible.
I'd like to take a look at the door he was trying to get through anyway, Hanrik said.
She followed him back to the servants' corridor, nodding as if she shared his concerns. The icy chill of the servants' corridors deepened the further they ventured. The age of the palace, even its side passages, had been something Ashiel could be proud of. They were a reminder that her home and her entire reign was built on old bones that had endured the ages without failing. Now, however, she saw them in a different way. She knew the darkness that her power had been founded in and could not shake the feeling that the cold and silence of the side corridors spoke to a dark, malevolent aspect of the palace's history that could never be permanently erased. Hanrik glanced over the unassuming door, looking for anything out of the ordinary. He held the lock in his hand, looking at the thick chains with the hawkish gaze of an investigator.
It looks like there's been some damage here, he said, gesturing to the door panel.
Ashiel disliked lying outright, but like any other social skill, it was one her father had drilled into her from a young age.
It's a biolock, isn't it?
A few of those in the palace are damaged from the time of Father's ascension, she said. Some of the biometric locks refused to accept Father's bio readings. Commander Sergei was in charge of the security transition, and you remember how he was. A loyal and effective man, but a bit of an amble in a ceramic shop. Hanrik regarded her for a moment, as if wondering how efficient an amble ceramicist would really be, then turned his gaze back to the lock in his hand. After a moment, he let the lock and chain fall. Ashiel smiled as he stepped away and offered her arm to him.
Do you know what's in there?
He asked. As aggravating as his persistence was, she admired his tenacity. She reflected that if he bought such dedication to his duties, his superiors probably valued him greatly. She had no doubt his career within the Adeptus Arbites would make her and her descendants proud,
but only if she managed to draw him away from his current focus first.
"Old decorations," she said, "I believe."
He gave her a quizzical look. "I'm pretty sure it's where they keep furnishings and ornaments that are of moderate value, but no longer in fashion or are in need of repair. Those Truvian feather quilts that were in vogue for a year or so, they're in there, although I think Mother may have given one of them to Lady Lazaroff after her daughter passed." She kept chattering away, gently guiding Henrik back towards the ballroom. Keeping up an endless stream of small talk was second nature to her, but inside, her mind was racing. If Tanzeg didn't have anything concrete on her, then she needed to figure out how to get something concrete on him. "If you don't mind my asking," she said, "what did you and Tanzeg discuss while I was educating his companion on the finer points of historical tapestries?" Henrik shook his head. "Nothing at all," he said. "He just took one of the serving napkins to wipe his shoes with." He gave her a quizzical stare. "I didn't consider it suspicious at the time. It's not an uncommon behaviour." He was right. The most fastidious or elitist of aristocrats and their servants sometimes chose to wipe their shoes off after trekking through servants' side halls. Even Group Captain Baron did. That was why she had trays of serving napkins stationed throughout the Colonnadium.
"Why? Do you think it was abnormal in some way?"
"Oh, no," Ashel said, waving her hand dismissively. "I just wanted to make sure he didn't take the opportunity to purloin one of the Marcorellian furnishings," she laughed. "I wouldn't put it past him."
Henrik nodded, a half-smile finally returning to his face. As a small child, she knew he had been convinced that someone was going to steal his mother's collection of Marcorellian silver, and had spent many social engagements keeping a wary eye on any guest who ventured too close to the glass cabinet they were kept in. The reminder of their earlier years seemed to do what her airy pleasantries had not, and put him back in the mindset of her little brother.
"If you see Group Captain Baron," she said, "would you have him come and find me?"
She seethed, trying to wrap her head around what she should do.
"More security issues?" asked Henrik.
"No," she said. "I just want to introduce him to some of the other nobles. See how he comports himself. If he's to become Lord Consort, it would be to everyone's benefit if he can navigate social scenes without embarrassment."
When possible, it was always best to hide a lie firmly inside the truth. She had intended to vet Baron's social skills, and he was on her shortlist for a potential Lord Consort. Henrik stared at her in puzzlement.
"I hadn't realised you had any sort of feelings for him," he said as they re-entered the ballroom.
The second musical arrangement had begun a slow Pellucidian bolero, a song of love lost and found. The slow, mournful notes of the stringed ensemble were perfectly chosen for the high arched ceiling of the ballroom. The acoustics of the room favoured the sad, romantic music. Many of the guests shuffled slowly together across the dance floor. Many more strolled along the windows in the lower light of the Colonnadium mechanate, enjoying private conversations in the picturesque atmosphere.
"I don't," she shrugged. "Not any strong ones, at any rate. But he's healthy, loyal, and competent. His service record is exemplary, and his family is well positioned enough to avoid embarrassment, but not so well that they would pose a political threat."
"You would think that his position as officer of reconnaissance would preclude his service in that regard," said Henrik. "Although I admit I'm not the most well-versed in protocols of this nature."
"It's not unheard of."
The Matkissons turned to see Acelia Venason and her daughter swooping out of the crowd of those near the side of the ballroom. Ashiel wasn't particularly surprised. She had never before seen Acelia Venason dance.
"Lady Venason," Ashiel said, inclining her head politely.
Henrik bowed respectfully to the matriarch.
"A number of governors have been wed to military officers, including the heads of their own high service,"
the old lady said.
"Typically, the consort will officially resign their post, although in practice they tend to take responsibility for the administration of the high service after marriage, thus continuing their office, in fact, if not in title. Should we be expecting a wedding invitation in the near future?
Irena asked. She sipped coquettishly at her flute of wine. I don't think so, Ashel said. If Acelia's daughter thought she could embarrass her, she had another thing coming.
Or did you mean I should be expecting one? Your brother and the young lady he brought seemed quite taken with one another. I scarcely even recognised her. Is that one of Lord Bruziel's daughters?
She held up one hand as if struck by sudden inspiration.
If they're serious, we should all have a drink together. Wouldn't that be delightful? Where is she?
She needed to find out how much Tanzeg knew about what had happened to Lostrovsky. She knew he was involved in the assassination attempt, but she still couldn't have him arrested without some form of definitive proof. If she could corner him, she might be able to draw out how much he had gleaned. With any luck, she could also find some charge to have him arrested on, something the Grevenet couldn't hold against her. Irena glared at her, while Acelia smiled graciously. Ashiel was grateful that Henrik had enough sense to keep quiet.
Unfortunately, she and Tanzig decided to leave early. They made their goodbyes some time ago.
Acelia smiled grimly.
He said something about a moonlight stroll back to our manor.
Why would he have left early? Were the Venaissans still planning an attack? They couldn't be, or Acelia wouldn't have endangered herself by staying here. No, Tanzig had left his mother and sister behind deliberately. Whatever purpose he'd had in the side hall was already completed. If he was on foot, there was little chance she would find him. Ashel swallowed back panic. She needed to get out of there, but she had locked herself into a conversation.
Did you mention you were looking for Group Captain Baron, Mum?
Henrik leaned into her field of view, pointing through the crowd to where Fidel was directing one of his subordinates. A flood of relief could have carried her away. She squeezed Henrik's arm affectionately. Was it possible he was more politically astute than she'd given him credit for? No matter if he'd been giving her an intentional out or just aligning with her goals through a happy accident, she was grateful for the assistance.
Why, thank you, Henrik.
She favoured the Venaissans with a gracious smile. If you'll excuse me, ladies.
Group captain,
she said, approaching from Baron's other side. She put one arm through his and leaned in conspiratorially. She guided the group captain out of the ballroom, conscious of the eyes upon her. To his credit, Baron accepted her arm graciously, but didn't lean in or become overly familiar. Once in the hall, beyond the sight of prying eyes, he pulled away from her and straightened, ever the picture of duty and professionalism.
Mom?
Exercise discretion, but I need you to find Tanzeg Venaissan immediately. She had no time to explain to the group captain, but he didn't seem to require any. He nodded, executed a crisp spin, and strode down the hall. The moment he was gone, Ashiel was off. Smiling, nodding, she weaved her way through the crowd of nobles, edging around to the same door they had come in. Something was eating at her, a nagging instinct that Tanzeg had not had his con artist distract her for no reason. If she could figure out why, it might give her an idea of what the Venaissan had been up to. The tray of serving napkins, set out for any guest who might feel the need to use them, remained where it should have been. Ashiel looked around the base of the high table it had been placed on, but found no evidence of a used specimen. After a moment, she pulled one of the napkins down and pinching it between her thumb and middle finger, even she had been surprised how quickly she had adapted to the missing forefinger, dropped it onto the floor. Nothing happened immediately, so she drifted around the colonnadium, keeping an eye on the discarded cloth, exchanging pleasant small talk with any noble who came close enough to require a response. Ostap was ready to be done with the banquet. The Lord Governor had left her dais, either on business or to mingle with her guests, so there was little chance of an audience. And if he were honest with himself, even less reason for one. The receiving of guests at the devotional banquet was traditional, but by no means required, and no one ever expected a Lord Governor to sit and listen to every single guest. The event would last for days if that was the case.
Ostap could afford to be a little more efficient. He had an advantage over Ashiel Mathieson, in that no one actually wanted to talk to him. So his conversations with many of the Longreves and Margreves had been delightfully short. Their family members, on the other hand, were frequently keen to converse with a member of the Grevenet that would deign to speak to someone who was not a member of that august assembly. So he had passed the hours listening to the eclectic musical arrangements, perusing the governor's vast collection of art pieces, occasionally dancing with an elderly matron, and engaging in an endless stream of conversations that were by turns odd, wheedling, or frightfully tedious. If he served long enough in the Grevenet, and given his family's opinion of the governing body, there was every chance he would serve there until his death, then some of these secondary family members might eventually be named ministers, or even lords of their houses, and might be more favourably inclined to an outspoken Greve they remembered fondly from social engagements in the past. This was only a secondary interest to him, however. His primary goal at such events was always to find other family members like himself. The hangers-on, the superfluous children, or the administrative assistants who were sidelined by their houses for having the wrong pedigree or for being politically inconvenient, but whose views and goals aligned with his own. Ostap wielded only a little power in the grand scheme of things, but he sometimes found it within his purview to grant assistance to such potential allies, and he knew that if only a few of them were ever in a situation to repay him, their intervention might one day prove to be the critical support he needed in a future endeavour. Still, the whole evening had begun to wear him out. Forcing himself to pretend to be civil with the likes of the Brugels and Winnevox left him feeling hollowed out and depleted, as though he'd just run from one end of the city to the other. He'd even smiled and played nice with the two Venaissin siblings, both of whom had reacted to his presence as though he had wretched on their shoes. He would have loved nothing more than to depart early and retire to the small villa his family had on the edge of the Costovium, to pass away the remainder of the evening with a small glass of Amazek, a long Estradian cigar, and a thick book. There were, however, still many forgotten siblings and hideaway cousins to meet, attempt to charm and try to ingratiate himself with. He just needed a moment to himself to pull his mind back together. When one of the musical ensembles began playing the lively horns of The Call of the Grainier, and most of the assembled wealthy elite began shuffling to the open floor like grinning fools to participate in the popular Kostoki dance, Ostap took the moment to slip from the ballroom into the colonnadium mechanate, eager to steal a few seconds of respite. In a corner of the columned hallway, he found a small display of paintings with only a lone guest, staring quietly at the art on the wall. Her back was to him, and Ostap scarcely even glanced at her. He turned instead to gaze out of the window, across the dark forested hills east of the palace. Swooping vorhawks glided over the trees, their serene flight paths a calming sight.
Tedious, is it not?
Ostap didn't want to engage the woman in conversation, but thought it might be rude to stand behind her and say nothing at all. The paintings? She asked, her voice coming from over his shoulder.
Well, the people,
he allowed himself a wry chuckle. She laughed briefly as well. I might agree, but if I did, I suspect that some of the guests might take offence, hearing such truths from their host. Ostap's head wheeled round. Lady Ashiel stood in the same place she had when he had entered. Her head turned to look at him. He felt his face flush immediately and cursed himself for his wagging tongue.
I meant no disrespect for Her Excellency or the company she chooses to invite to her palace, he stammered. I merely sought to diffuse any possible tension with...
You're quite all right, Lady Ashiel said, kindly interrupting his rambling before he spun himself into an anxiety-riddled wreck. You're neither the first introspective aristocrat to be bored by the pretension of these social events, nor shall you be the last. It's Minister Fominko, is it not?
Ostap, Excellency.
He bowed. I confess I needed a break myself, Ostap. Lady Ashiel gestured towards the array of paintings on the wall next to her. Many pieces in my collection were added precisely for the calming effect I find they bring. Are you a collector? Her calm and friendly demeanour did much to assuage his earlier panic. Ostap studied the paintings she had been viewing. They were irregularly sized, each portraying a different landscape, in a variety of seasons, and with a variety of foreground subject matter.
I am not, he said, although the stroke and composition leads me to believe these are by the same artist.
The Lord Governor nodded.
Indeed, by N. Camp, very ably spotted, Minister Fominko.
Ostap continued to look at the paintings. There was something about them that nagged at him. He leaned forward, hoping somewhere in the back of his mind that he didn't look too pretentious in front of Lady Matkison.
Are these meant to be the same property?
He asked. Lady Ashiel beamed a radiant smile at him, as though she were a tutor and he a prized pupil. Quite correct, Ostap. Most viewers fail to make that connection. May I ask what led you to this conclusion? Ostap pointed to one of the paintings.
This tree here, he said, is the same as this one in this larger piece over here. It's a decade or more apart in time, and you're seeing them from different angles, but you can clearly see that the primary fork is the same. And in the latter painting, you can make out a large knotting in the lower trunk, where the spike that held the no trespass sign from the first painting was eventually grown over.
Lady Ashiel laughed, a genuine laugh this time, not the politely reciprocal mirth she used before.
I've never noticed that particular detail, she said. But yes, the paintings were all made on the Vorskiv estate over the course of about 20 years.
She placed a gentle hand on his shoulder.
The collection is called Reaping Season. You really do have a wonderful eye for detail, Ostap. Any idea what the thrust of the work is?
He shrugged.
Oh, there, Excellency, I'm at the mercy of my scholastic ignorance. If I were to guess, I would say that it pertains to the inevitable degeneration of individual elements, despite the persistence of the collective. The Vorskiv estate still stands, as it has for hundreds of years, despite the buildings, plants and people dying and fading away. Even the landscape changes. But the estate itself remains, possibly meant as a metaphor for the Imperium as a whole.
A more complete and concise explanation of Encamp's reaping season I have never heard, Lady Ashiel praised. If you weren't so valuable in the Grevenet, I would insist a place be made for you at Trenkovi University.
Your Excellency is too kind, Ostap said.
He crossed his hands behind his back, uncomfortable with Lady Ashiel's praise.
I've accomplished quite little in my time, unfortunately. Truthfully, I'm just a bottom-tier minister with a chronic inability to keep my mouth shut. Any gains we make on your behalf are largely the result of Longrev Evanova or Margrev Eletovich.
I dare say you sell yourself short, Minister.
The Lord Governor turned her head to look at a napkin that had been discarded on the floor. Ostap realised she glanced at the same piece of detritus several times. As if realising she was fretting, she turned back to give him her full attention.
I understand you were the one who thought to use the Orvox Futures financing to block the Venasans' reappropriations last year. Ryvan Eletovich might have sponsored the resolution, but it was your insight that made it possible.
Ostap merely nodded. That was supposed to have been a secret. He had provided the legal chicanery that Margrev Eletovich needed to prevent the Venasans from allocating government funds to their own corrupt contracts. But he hadn't thought anyone but himself and the Eletovich family were aware of it.
Such diligence has paved the way, she said, for more than one dutiful minister to find themselves named with their own title and holdings eventually.
Ostap laughed nervously.
Oh, Your Excellency is most kind, as always. But it seems unlikely we shall see another lord named to the Grevenet for some time.
Naming a new Greven of any rank required unincorporated population centres to have grown large enough to require representation in the Grevenet. and there were few current prospects for that. Most unincorporated populations were on the decline.
Unless one of the current families were to be destroyed entirely, a tragic prospect that no one wishes to see pass, not to mention, of course, that I am ineligible to be named a lord, being currently unwed.
Lady Ashiel sat on one of the benches that lined the edge of the hall. Ostap wasn't sure if these too were antique pieces of art meant to be observed rather than used, but the Lord Governor waved him to sit as well.
"I had not realised," she said. "I had assumed you had a wife already. I'm certain that if you were so inclined, many of the women from the Kostoki families would be delighted to be wed to a new Grev."
Ostap couldn't quite tell if she was teasing him or not, but opted for casual self-deprecation anyway.
"Her Excellency flatters, of course. But the truth is I am a bitter man, possessed of a compulsion towards quarrelsomeness, who commands no vast wealth or impressive skill, and spends his free time being frightfully dull. These qualities might make a loyal, lower echelon politician, but they are not enticing commodities in the market of romance."
Lady Ashiel nodded. "Truthfully, you describe a great many of the Grevens, while leaving out their avarice and boorishness, which places you at the head of the procession to many. Does your family not consider it worthwhile to arrange a pairing for you?" Such arranged marriages were quite common. Ostap knew. Ruprecht and his bride had never even met one another before their wedding day, he'd been told.
"Alas, they view such an endeavour as a wasted effort. With multiple siblings before me, there would be little point, I suspect."
A higher-tier noble could offer an arrangement for him, of course, but there were even fewer nobles who would wish to have him as a relation.
"Though, truth be told, I find myself rarely interested in those I meet, at least in a romantic fashion. Potential matches who share my loyalties and similar interests to mine are, well, they're, you know, relatively rare, and usually interested in those who are far more interesting."
Lady Ashiel raised an eyebrow. "I've seen you in the company of several eligible young women this evening," she said. "You mean to tell me you haven't an interest in any of them?" Ostap looked away.
No.
He rarely found himself in situations where he was conversing with someone as a friend, and found the discussion of personal topics to be somewhat embarrassing.
"Not really, I should say."
"Not really?"
"I was captivated by the young lady accompanying Lord Venason," he confessed. "But she is, of course, accompanied, so there isn't much future there."
Lady Ashiel nodded. "I met her briefly. She seemed to have quite the mind for details. Not unlike yourself." Ostap shrugged and realised he'd become flushed.
I suppose so. Lord Tanzeg had no particular desire to speak to me, but she engaged me for a few minutes about classical Trenkovi literature. I was fairly surprised to find another so versed in the topic."
Lady Ashiel smiled again, as if he had confirmed something she suspected, as the up-tempo music in the ballroom began to die out, replaced by the slow swelling of a Navoshi dirge ballad. Ostap spotted a quietly trundling servitor headed in their direction.
"In any event," he said,
suddenly mortified that he had been so open with someone who had neither the need nor the desire to listen to his life story.
"I have business remaining yet, and I've occupied far too much of your time already."
The Lord Governor was standing as well. Ostap hurried towards the ballroom before he humiliated himself further. "Thank you for discussing the displays with me,"